The Accidental Entrepreneur is produced by Beinhacker Law and brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors. One of One Productions, the New Jersey-based podcast studio that produces and edits both audio and video podcasts. They sell equipment for the average podcaster and have even created a guesting kit exclusively for our listeners. North Authentic, the conscious hair care marketplace offering the cleanest brands from around the world. The Healthy Place, the e-commerce site with thousands of supplements to help you live a healthier life, along with natural solutions for chronic pain, stress, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, and much, much more. And be sure to support the podcast by ordering some logo merchandise from our online store. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
Like, you know, at Disney, I've had my hand in building internal software tools. This can't be that difficult. Let me give this a try. So that's why I pivoted and I said, if I could be entrepreneurial and try to make movies, I could probably be entrepreneurial and make a software product. Boy, I was wrong.
Well, was this you were going to do it, like program? Or
no, obviously
you
not.
Hire people to do that.
You find people to do it. Right. Yeah. And, came up with some ideas. We started doing it and miserably failed. Especially the first two times was a miserable failure because I was inexperienced. I didn't know what I didn't know.
Right.
And, but my mindset was always not failure. I mean, even to this day, I never think of anything as failure. It's always
a learning
experience.
What
did I learn?
Right. There's no question.
What did I learn? Yeah. Because when I would analyze kind of the worst case scenario was, well, the worst case scenario, we just lost a little bit of money. My day job is still here. Like my life didn't change because I failed. So I really looked at it as learning. It took probably about 7 or 8 failures until I started to understand the process better. Understanding the idea, ideation, and kind of validating the idea.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hi, I'm Martin Nazarian, media executive, entrepreneur, and author.
Okay. Artin.
It's like Artin. Martin without the M.
Oh, good. That's a good way to say it. Artin. So my grandfather's name was Martin. So we were talking about family and kids and off mic and everything, but I guess when it comes down to it, that's what you do it all for, right? For family and kids and things like that. But I know you have a really interesting backstory, you know, growing up and where you came from, but maybe you want to start there and then we'll move up through your corporate experience and then to some of your entrepreneurial ventures.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Armenian by nationality, but, some of your audience is not aware. There was Armenian genocide back in 1915. And just prior to that, that kind of caused a lot of Armenians to disperse in that Eastern Europe, Middle East area. So my great-great-grandparents ended up in Iran, and that's where I was born.
Right, because there is no country. There's no country named Armenia anymore, right?
There is, yeah.
Oh, there is. Okay, where's Armenia?
It's right between Iran and Turkey.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, very small. I think the population in Armenia is about 3 to 4 million.
Oh. Small.
And you have another 3 to 4 million diaspora across the globe everywhere.
It's a small. Right.
The population in the world is small of Armenia.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, so when I was born in 77, so shortly after that is when the Iranian revolution started and the Shah was kicked out. And anybody who's not familiar with that story, fascinating story, because U.S. and the British were involved. It's fascinating. You guys should look into that. But that caused the country to go from kind of a moderate Muslim nation to an extreme, what it is now, and basically no relationship with the Western world.
Right.
And being, you know, Christian minorities in there wasn't a good fit for us. What kind of tipped, you know, what broke the straw in the camel's back was in 1980 is when the Iran-Iraq war started.
Right.
And it wasn't kind of your civilized war. You know, I think when people think of Iraq, they probably think of Desert Storm or, you know, what happened after 9/11, more strategic laser missile guided, you know, none of that.
No.
It was Iraqi planes flying over crowded cities and just dropping bombs.
Yeah.
It was more scare tactic. So I remember clearly being five, six, seven, where the windows all had X's with duct tape or some kind of tape on them.
Yeah.
And that was to prevent, you know, if a bomb dropped close by, the sonic boom from the,
it wouldn't break the windows.
The bomb would, even if it broke the window, it would just fall down instead of,
you know, bursting into your apartment. Right.
Exactly.
Now, for those people listening, 1980 was like right after the hostage crisis, which really was a result of, I guess, we harbored the Shah when he got thrown out of Iran, right? And the Persians left and all that kind of stuff. And then Reagan was the president then. So it was, we were talking, well, now 40 years, you know, 40 years ago. So.
40 years. Yeah. So very turmoil period.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing I remember is whenever the Iraqi plane would fly over, there was a siren that would come on TV and on radio. And it was more like a spectacle. People would go on rooftops
to watch
the anti-aircraft missiles shooting up because it looked like fireworks.
Yeah.
And it became kind of this thing that you do. Bizarre time. I could never get it out of my memory. One of the really crazy memories was a bomb dropped maybe a block away from our house. And, we were kids, so the next morning we went there, and literally within hours, bulldozers had just flattened that entire lot where that building was on before, and who knows how many people died in that building, but it was just surreal.
Yeah.
But, you know, that kind of led to my family and my parents saying, we got to get the kids out of here. This is not a place to raise minority Christian kids in this type of a country. And as refugees, we ended up in Spain.
Okay.
And crazy story about that. On the way out of Iran on the airplane, apparently there was a bombing attack and our plane got hit and one of the engines went down.
Really?
But my dad kept that a secret from us.
You didn't know.
Because he knew. I didn't know until very recently.
Really?
I think he had told my mom a year later, because if he had told my mom during the flight, she would have probably had a heart attack.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Yeah. So one engine down and made it to Madrid. And we lived in Madrid for about a year until we were eligible for a green card. And that's how we made it to Southern California, where we are now.
Right.
In Spain. You know, I was this Armenian kid, spoke Armenian and Farsi at the time, no Spanish, no English.
Right.
So I had to kind of make my, I was in fourth grade and I started drawing for all the other students. I still kind of have that ability to draw animated characters.
Yeah.
And it kind of became my first entrepreneurial venture looking back.
Right. Your little business.
Fourth grade is like
10. You were like 10 years old?
I was like 10 years old, yeah.
But how did you, but you're in the United States, right? So the school teachers definitely didn't teach her speak your language, right? So how did you communicate? How did you get through school
you're in fourth grade, you know, you don't need sign language. Even if you wrote it, it wouldn't be in English.
No, it wouldn't. No. You know, it's interesting. When I think about it back, I never felt like out of place. I never felt like I was singled out in any way. I feel like me learning English happened very quickly. And maybe that's why.
Maybe because you're young. Yeah. So you never really felt like you felt like you understood everything and you kind of were finding your way. It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember in fifth grade, my elementary school tapped me to be an interpreter. So I was translating for the Hispanic kids that were just coming to the school.
So you already picked up Spanish and you picked up English like within a year.
Yeah. So now I was a translator for them as an Armenian kid. This odd situation, but
I guess multiple languages gets easier, right?
Yeah. So that's why I know I probably picked up English fast because I was translating it by the fifth grade.
Okay. I'm just always curious, you know, what you're going through because you wonder. I do see kids when my kids were young in elementary school. There were some kids that moved from other countries and they didn't speak a word of English. Now they do. But you always wonder what do they really understand what you're saying? I guess in a lot of kids figure it out, you know, when you're resilient.
Yeah, I think so too. And especially now that I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, watching them absorb new things so quickly just amazes me. I'm like, are all kids this smart? Right. Yeah, I don't want to be biased and say, oh, my kids are smarter. I just feel like kids are just smarter. They can absorb things.
Yeah, well, you got like a new computer and it's running fast and it's pulling things in all the time. Now, let's say you were in fourth and fifth grade. So were you behind in school when you got here? Or was it, were you, no, you're pretty much on board, huh?
Okay. No, pretty much on track. You know, went on to junior high and high school in Glendale, California.
Okay.
And the one positive thing about Glendale, California, I'm not in Glendale, California now, but I grew up there. It became kind of this point of immigration for a lot of Armenians.
Oh.
So by the time I was in, all of a sudden there's a community there. So never felt like completely out of touch with your own language or others. So that was good.
Right.
And by the time I got to high school, being in LA, I was exposed to the film industry. So I'm like, ooh.
Hard not to be, right?
Yeah, I'm like, so that's what I want to do. And luckily, my parents were very supportive. So I kind of went down the film school path. And, you know, once I got to the general studies and started focusing on making short films, I was very intrigued by it because of that glitz and glamour of the industry. And you see the Oscars and all that. By the time I made my first short film, or maybe it was the second, my thought process changed. I kind of realized that liking the industry because of the glitz and glamour was the wrong reason to get into any industry.
Yeah.
Because that's just the facade that you see. Right, everything happens behind the scenes out there.
Yeah.
So
now, did you go to a 4-year traditional university that had a film program?
I did.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay.
In Southern California. So very common. And by the time I was making my thesis project, which was, over 20 years ago, at the time, I don't know what they do now, but at the time, you either had to produce your own short film or have a significant role in somebody else's.
Okay.
So, and then the school would pick 5 projects to provide some funding for.
Oh.
Luckily, mine was picked. So I got a $5,000 grant to make my
like a little film. Shark Tank type of thing for film.
It was. Yeah. I had to pitch, do the whole thing. So it was very much entrepreneurial. And well, we totally messed up a couple of days of the shooting. So I had to redo a lot of it, but I didn't have the money.
And you mean you had used the money at that point?
Yeah. I'd already used up all the $5,000.
Oh.
So, you know, when I look back now, it was very entrepreneurial of me, the stuff that I did.
Sure.
I basically came up with a film festival at the school because there was none. And my thought was, everybody here making these movies, I'm sure they're like me. What they would love is for their short film to be recognized.
Right.
And that jumpstarts their career. I'm like, okay, so if I do a film festival, I should get entries. So I created posters, plastered all over the campus. And next thing you know, there's these $50 checks coming to my parents' house. And they're wondering, what the hell am I doing?
Right. Exactly. What illegal activities like, are you involved with?
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, just, mom, dad, don't worry. It's all legal. Just put the checks aside. I ended up raising the money that way and finishing my film. And once my film was finished, the Southern California, they get all of the film schools kind of come together and do a showcase of kind of the best film schools, film shorts for that year, student shorts.
Right.
And luckily mine was selected and it was a big theater, red carpet, there's press there. And that's where I had my first real aha moment. And because when my short came up on screen, my name said directed and produced by Artem Nazarian, my parents were sitting on my left. And when I looked at them, the pride and the smile felt from them was incredible. And that's where I knew that the glitz and glamour was the wrong reason. Doing it because I like building things, sure. But the real reason I was doing things was I wanted to make my parents proud. And that kind of became my guiding light, my
motivation,
North Star. Everything I do is to just make my parents proud because I know the sacrifices they went through, what they dealt with to be refugees and get us here. So knowing that emotion is what I'm after simplified my thought process and thinking. And it wasn't this pressure on me to say success only means X. But
right.
It actually turns out success can mean a lot of things. And as long as I work hard and give it all.
Yeah. I was going to say in order to finish your project, right, you created this film festival. You had the festival, I assume, right? Because people paid to go in, right?
They
so
did.
But that was a one-time deal, right? You did the festival once, you raised the money.
Yeah. One-time
Look,
deal.
That's very now, creative of you. I mean, you know, resourceful.
And you know, the setup was I wanted to make sure that it didn't come across as a con because
people
spend money. And so what I had done was I was interning at Sony Pictures at the time. So I got a few executives from Sony to be judges. And the top movies from the festival got screened at a Sony theater.
Nice.
At the movie theater. So
it all worked out.
The students that participated actually got a benefit out of it too.
Okay, good. All right, good. So then, because then you went to they got picked for the real festival.
Yeah. Yeah. All that was interesting too. You know, once I came out of film school, trying to find my footing and, you know, what am I going to do in this industry? Obviously every film student is coming out, wants to be a writer, a producer, director. That's kind of the ambition. Easier said than done. Definitely who you know is not a cliche.
For everything. Yeah.
And I was working at Macy's Women's Shoes, supporting myself while kind of transitioning from a college student to a professional contributing to society.
Okay.
And with a close friend of mine, and this lady came to the register to pay for shoes at Macy's. And I saw her credit card and it had the Disney Castle logo on there.
Okay.
So I tapped my buddy and I said, hey, is she working from Disney? So we started chatting with her. Turns out she was working at Disney.
Okay.
And we asked her what she does. She said, the world. Like, we don't know what that means. So she kind of started explaining. It turns out she was in the distribution side of the business where they were distributing VHS. And this is when DVD was brand new.
Right.
And they were getting into DVD distribution and the department was going. So she's like, send me your resume and we'll see what we can do. A month later, both me and my buddy Michael got a call and they were hiring in this distribution division. We went, as I'm driving out of the parking lot, I got a call from the HR department there and said, can you start in a week? I was like, sure, better than Macy's.
That was like, so you did your interview, you're driving out and they called you?
Yeah.
That's exactly a lot better than happened. Macy's. You didn't go to college to sell women's shoes for the rest of your life.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and that's how I landed at Disney. And
was that more of a, Artin, was that more of a, like a sales role? Because it was distribution, you're working on, or was it more like
it was
coordinating the logistics of everything?
It was more supply chain and logistics. Kind of the business side of it instead of the sales side of it.
Right.
And, you know, a few years into this, both Michael and I, because we both got hired there, we turned on each other. We said, we didn't sign up for this. You know, we wanted to be filmmakers. What happened to that drive? Right. So that kind of jumpstart us again to pursue things on the side.
Okay.
The term side gig or side hustle wasn't then.
Yeah.
Now it is, definitely. So we started doing things on the side.
It was called moonlighting in those days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So we started writing some scripts, and we almost got a few hits where we sold them, but they backed out at the last minute because of they did their research and they thought there were some other similar movies coming out soon. Or this one executive that was really interested in a horror script of ours got laid off.
And yeah, that happens.
Our contact was gone.
So what you would do. You would submit them to studio executives, wherever you can get them in front of, to see if they would bite. That's how the industry works, right?
Yeah. You basically send a query letter. If you have an agent, better, but some producers accept submissions without an unsolicited submission where an agent is not involved. So that's what we're doing, because we didn't have an agent.
Right.
But we got responses. You know,
It's true entrepreneurial industry. I mean, you're producing content, you're creatively writing, and you're submitting it to people, hopefully that they'll buy. Or at least give you a meeting, right? You want at least a pitch meeting. So,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, now that what I know today, making a movie is truly an entrepreneur project. There's nothing different about it than any other venture that you would do, whether it's software or, you know, a product or a service. It's very entrepreneurial. So that's what we kind of started doing, the side things, but nothing was really sticking.
Yeah.
And this is, 2005, 2006.
You're still doing distribution at Disney.
And we're still at Disney. Yeah, our day jobs are still there.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Looking to get into podcasting? Maybe to market your business for your own enjoyment or because you have a message you want to get out there. One of One Productions is a New Jersey-based studio just over the George Washington Bridge that caters to the booming business of podcasting. They offer a comfortable atmosphere using the latest technology available to record your podcast. And they are a full-service media company offering both audio and video production services, creating both audio and video podcasts, as well as video shorts for business and personal use. Professional audio equipment packages are available through their website for all budgets. And be sure to check out their podcast guesting kit, created specially for our listeners. Care for your health. Care for the planet. And look flippin' great doing it. North Authentic is a conscious hair care marketplace offering the cleanest brands from around the world. Their pro stylists curate only the most fabulous non-toxic hair products with better-for-you shampoos, serums, masks, and more that actually give you gorgeous hair without hurting your health or the planet. Hey, you've only got one life, one planet, and one glorious mane. Might as well treat them all as best you can, right? Try a 100% clean hair care routine prescribed just for you using their link in the show notes. If you don't see a big, beautiful difference in how your hair looks and feels, you can tell them they're crazy. Do you battle chronic pain, stress, anxiety, or depression? Well, if you take any supplements or you're interested in natural alternatives, you need to know about findyourhealthyplace.com. Find Your Healthy Place has thousands of supplements to help you live a better quality of life, as well as natural solutions for chronic pain, stress, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, and much, much more. Need guidance? Use their live chat feature and talk to a wellness consultant right on their website. And be sure to use our coupon code TAEPODCAST for all your purchases to get the best prices at findyourhealthyplace.com. Follow their links in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
I just started looking more broad in what's happening in the world. And post-dot-com bubble, there was a lot of money being invested in technology. You know, this is MySpace was hot. Facebook was just started. YouTube was about to. I mean, there's a lot going on with companies that are billion-dollar companies now. And I'm like, you know, at Disney, I've had my hand in building internal software tools. This can't be that difficult. Let me give this a try. So that's why I pivoted and I said, if I could be entrepreneurial and try to make movies, I could probably be entrepreneurial and make a software product. Boy, I was wrong.
Well, but was this you were going to do it, like program? Or
no, obviously
you
not.
Hire people to do that.
You find people to do it. Right. Yeah. And, came up with some ideas. We started doing it and miserably failed. Especially the first two times was a miserable failure because I was not experienced. I didn't know what I didn't know.
Right.
And, but my mindset was always not failure. I mean, even to this day, I never think of anything as failure. It's always
a learning
experience.
What did
I learn?
Right. There's no question.
What
about
did
it.
I learn? Yeah. Because when I would analyze kind of the worst case scenario was, well, the worst case scenario, we just lost a little bit of money. My day job is still here. Like my life didn't change because I failed. So I really looked at it as learning. It took probably about 7 or 8 failures until I started to understand the process better. Understanding the idea, ideation, and kind of validating the idea, getting feedback.
Still, you're still talking software business. The software business.
All software. Yeah. Those failures were all software failures. And once I really found my footing and understanding that process of building a product and service, I was able to raise about $4 million and finally building the successful product. We built a hospitality platform and it became a pretty big project because all of a sudden we were on the web, on the iPhone, on the Android, on the iPad. So it was a pretty large enterprise software that we built, and we deployed it in LA and Vegas and Miami. And that was really fun. But
who were your customers?
Restaurants and nightlife operators.
So that was the target market. They would use the software to, what was the software do for them?
The software was meant to be operational efficiency, but then also managing a promotional activity. And then eventually we got into tickets and VIP table sales as well.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And it was a lot of work. And you know, I definitely want to stress that it's a lot of work. And not only the building of it, but then the rolling out a product is a lot of work. And being that, you know, the hospitality industry typically operates late at night. I had to stay up late and be at these venues to not only onboard them, but then watch how they use the product and get feedback because it was pretty intense.
Yeah.
If something went wrong, there are thousands of dollars at risk. And five years into this, I got engaged and I just wasn't feeling it anymore that I want to continue doing this and be up at night until 1, 2, 3 a.m. And then the opportunity for an acquisition came up to another startup. Okay. And I voted on it, and luckily others
you mean
did
for
too.
You guys to be acquired?
Yeah, to be acquired.
Okay.
And it took a while, but eventually that's what happened. In hindsight, I was like, wow, good timing, because COVID would have devastated us.
COVID?
It was, maybe a year before COVID.
Wow.
I had stepped out.
Yeah, right, because the whole restaurant nightclub business was shut down.
Yeah. I had stepped out of the day-to-day management of the company a few years before that, but I still had a large stake in it. So it was about a year before where the acquisition happened.
And you were at Disney while this was going on, or you left Disney? You were out on your...
No, I was at Disney this whole time.
Oh, you were?
My goal was... Yeah, my goal was to leave Disney. But because of the way things played out and me wanting to not have to deal with nightlife and restaurants, I decided to come back to Disney.
Right.
I was always at Disney, but mentally coming back to Disney.
I see. So after you sold out, you said, I'm going to refocus on Disney with family life. Okay. And what were you doing at Disney? Still distribution at Disney?
I was still in distribution, but I had really evolved my role there too. So what ended up happening in 2005 or six, I can't remember the exact date. A really high up senior leader at Disney came to me and said, I have a secret project for you. Are you interested? I
was like, secret sounds secret. Good to me, right?
I'm good. Yeah. cutting the story short, turns out the secret project was a handshake deal that Bob Iger and Steve Jobs did to put content on the video iPod. Right. And that basically resulted in me becoming digital distribution employee number one at Walt Disney Studios.
And that they just had the iPod in those days, right? So they just got to the point where it was all music and now they're doing video. You didn't have it on your phone or any of that stuff, right?
No, right. There was no such thing. The iPhone was a few years away still.
Yeah.
And that's I started a digital distribution.
Yeah, you were like in the early days. Wow.
Yeah. So, and that's kind of why I had a really good setup at Disney where this is great for trying to see what's next after my startup. This is I basically was an entrepreneur inside Disney. That's what I felt like.
Because
It was from the ground up, I had to build something from scratch that didn't exist. And the interesting thing that was happening, I leveraged a lot of my Disney learnings on the side startups. The successful startup, things kind of shifted where my pace of learning was actually faster outside of Disney. So then I was bringing it back to Disney and people were noticing that I'm bringing all these fresh ideas and solving problems. So I kept getting promoted really quickly at Disney.
Right,
too.
Right.
It was this very interesting thing that happened and positioned me well, which is why I returned. And eventually kind of my role at Disney now is more on the strategy side of things. With Disney Plus and the acquisition of Fox, we have to figure out how do we integrate these two companies. And it's a lot of work. Integrating the cultures of two massive companies is not easy. So that's kind of where I'm at now. But once...
So even with your entrepreneurial ventures over the years, you still remained at Disney. You're still there today.
Yep, I'm still there today.
No, I didn't realize that. I thought you had left Disney and then started this other entrepreneur.
I was going to leave again. And after this hospitality company, I was again set up with corporate world and I started another startup. And that's when my wife got pregnant. I was like, okay, wait a minute. I'm a huge reader, especially nonfiction books around biography, self-help, leadership. And whenever I read a lot of these super uber successful people about these successful people, always towards the end, there's these little nuggets of information they, sprinkle in the book around, I wish I had spent more time with my son.
Right.
I wish I had done this. And I kept seeing this common thing. So I told myself, if I'm reading these books to extract value from their experience around business, why would I ignore that part of the advice that they're giving? Yeah. So I kind of told myself, I want to be an active and present dad. And by that meant I can't do another tech startup on the side because the hours were grueling.
Of course.
On the hospitality, I was up 5 a.m., to 8:30 on the startup, Then I had Disney. Then 7 to like 10 or 11, it was a startup.
Yeah, you obviously can't keep doing that if you want family.
No, I couldn't. So I stopped the tech startup, but I was itching what to do. And I had so many people asking me, I have an idea. How do I make this happen? Or how'd you do this both on the same time?
Right.
And then I was invited to give some talks at my school and other organization. I thought to myself, you know, writing a book is another entrepreneurial venture. I've never done this before, so I have to figure out how to do it. Especially if I go to self-publishing route, I have to learn how to market it, sell it. Yeah. Like it's all of it again. I'm like, this is great. Plus, I can write at home and not miss out on my son growing up. So that's why I pivoted from a tech startup to writing a book, which released April of this year. And it was all about my experience of how to excel in the corporate world, but also pursue something on the side, and maybe eventually turn that side gig into a full-time thing.
And it's available online, like Amazon? And
it's available Amazon, Audible, anywhere books are sold. It became immediately became an Amazon bestseller, just because the topic is fairly relevant for today's world, and everybody is trying to use COVID as a time to step right. back and say, "Is what I'm doing life now something yeah. that I want to do?" Yeah. So the timing of it accidentally turned out to be good. Because I definitely didn't write. It took 3.5 years to write the book, so it was way before COVID. Right. But I didn't know COVID was going to happen.
So with regard to Disney, it sounded like you did a lot of startups for them in terms of divisions that they started and things like that. How long was the iPod movie project secret?
Probably for like 6 months. Six months for me, I'm sure. Right. For at the C-suite level, it was a secret much longer.
Right. Yeah, it was probably they were working on it for a long time. Well, obviously, you've seen what happens with the world now. Everybody's got a smartphone and their kids are watching movies. I think my kids watch the phone more than they watch the television. I mean, they just, you know, because it's just crazy. Yeah.
Well, my son thinks YouTube is television.
Of course. Why wouldn't you? Yeah. There won't be major networks in the future. They'll have streaming apps like they do now. So the content's going to, yeah. I mean, I guess everyone does, right? There's Paramount, Peacock, Disney Plus, ABC, you know, Hulu, Netflix. I mean, they're all, those are the networks now. It's just different. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with live TV. I guess live TV will be on like ABC and it'll be on their app and you only need internet connection. You won't need like actual, cable. You know, just a different delivery system. Yeah. It's changed completely.
Yeah, definitely changed. I mean, as a consumer, the only reason I have live TV is sports. I'm a huge right. sports fan. But I know people that don't care about sports are the cord cutters.
Yeah, but eventually those will be on, you know, NBC Sports app, ABC Sports app, and you'll get it live. NFL, can watch the games. There are some limitations with NFL. My son sometimes can't get the Giants game out in Indiana at college because they black it out or whatever, but... my daughter had some trouble with streaming on ABC the other day at school. I can't figure out if it's her school or their Wi-Fi. I don't know what it is, but you know, they call me up, Dad, I want to watch my show. They pull up the app.
Yeah. I think it's digital rights.
Yeah. Maybe. Right.
There's a lot of issues still with old contracts that prevent something to be online, but you could be on cable. So I think it's just a matter of time until those contracts start renewing.
I see. So for example, she's in Maryland, right? So there may be the local cable provider that has the rights to show ABC and you can't get the live stream, right?
Yeah, they have an exclusive deal and it's not going to be anywhere. So it's just a matter of time. I think these contracts are going to renew and it'll shift to digital streaming everywhere.
Well, that may be the problem because he gets it fine over in Indiana. It's not an issue. She must have an issue. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm in Southern California. I can't get my Lakers on my YouTube TV because Comcast Spectrum has a exclusive right to distribute Laker games. So
got it. You can get rebroadcast, but you can't get live.
I can't get live. Yeah. And I hate watching rebroadcast sports because I already know this.
Oh my God. So. You can't get away from finding out. Even if you wanted to, you're going to find out what happened.
I'm going to find out. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, somebody text message, somebody's going to tell me the score.
Of course. Absolutely. All right. So, what's, up in the future? So you have your books out now, obviously that's why you're on the podcast. You've been connecting and talking and speaking about it. What's your future with Disney and where you think you're going from here? Your kid, well, you got little kids, so you still got to stick home for a while. So.
Yeah. I got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. They just turned 3 and 1. So pretty new. And
so you're exhausted. You
know, blessing in the sky. I'm exhausted, but you know, COVID has been a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
Luckily, my family hasn't been impacted by COVID. So seeing them grow every day has been a blessing. This is my home office. So just being able to walk out and say, hi, guys, whenever I want has been
right.
Really fun.
Are you going back to the office now or still not yet?
It's still up in the air. It'll be in 2022 when we figure out what the back to office plan is.
Got it.
So still a few months at least of full-time.
Yeah. Work. Well, you got to see your kids grow up a little bit, you know?
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
And even when we go back, it's not going to be full-time. It's going to be like a hybrid model. So it's still good. At Disney, I'm heavily involved in a lot of strategy stuff right now. I'm kind of figuring out how are we transitioning into a streaming business,
right,
from the traditional business. But I have a lot of personal plans as far as my book goes. This is what it looks like.
There you go.
I have a second book in mind that I'm kind of playing around with, doing some bullet points and notes on. But I'm also very interested. You know, one of the main reasons I wrote the book was I wanted to help people that were me 20 years ago,
right,
fast track to their goal instead of making 7 miserable failures, get there quickly and faster than me. And doing that with a book is one approach, but I also want to convert the book into some online courses as well. So I can get more into the weeds and details of some of the X's and O's of how to do things that you can't cover in a book because it'll turn into an encyclopedia series.
And it's a side hustle book, right? I mean, it's about having a side job or
absolutely
what interest outside of whatever corporate, don't give up your corporate job. You can do other things at the same time.
Absolutely. And how you actually leverage your corporate job to make it happen on the side. Cause there's a lot of people go into something on the side blind,
right.
But if you just step out of your box in whatever job you're given and don't get stuck by that job description,
right?
Step out of that job description, take ownership and learn how the marketing department works, learn how the technology, like just learn about other areas and other disciplines.
Right. Pretend like you're an entrepreneur, like you own the company and learn. About
yeah. And it's the best MBA you can get from real world because you're actually seeing it happen.
Yeah.
And you won't come out of it with a huge MBA debt either. So that's another.
You won't have all kinds of student loans.
All right. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you coming out, spending some time with me. The book, could you hold up the book again?
Of course.
Right. Side Adventure. It's available on Amazon. We'll put links in the show notes so people can find it. And, we all love Disney, right? Everybody loves the mouse. So I appreciate us getting connected, I think, through one of your publicists. And good luck with the kids. I mean, I've been there. I told you my youngest is 10th grade, so I'm not exhausted anymore, but to a certain extent I am. And then you get dogs, by the way, they wake you up at 6 a.m. to go out. You're like, what am I doing this for? You know?
Yeah, we got the dog before the kids. I got used to
it. Yeah, well. Yeah, like I said, it goes really, really fast. It speeds up. But I appreciate you coming on. Thank you for your time.
No, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.